This is Ben from Chemist, and you're listening to Toilet of Hell.
You're listening to 66.6 FM, Radio TOVH, The Flush.
Well, hi there, everybody. Welcome to another thrilling episode of Toilet Radio. If this is your first show, what we do here is we offer you metal-related diversions that make your commute suck just a little bit less. We interview artists, like today. We've got Ben from Chemist on. We also do shows where we talk about the news. We do shows where we discuss the history of this genre you all know and love. And we do shows that are just straight nothing but jokes about metal. That's my favorite, personally. But if this is your first episode, welcome. If this is your 100th episode, thanks for sticking with us. If you like the show, you want to hear more, you can always subscribe to our Patreon, where you can get bonus episodes of Toilet Radio. You can also get, cool shit like a handmade mixtape that I'll make for you every month. Just go over there and give us some money. That's a cool thing. And also be sure to like, subscribe, and rate us on iTunes, because that's the only way that we're going to get ahead of whatever horrible reactionary conservative iTunes shows on the top 10. Anyway, let's go ahead and get this one started. Welcome back to another exciting episode of the Toilet of Hell Radio Show. We got a very special guest with us today. We got Ben of Colorado Doom Band, Chemist. How's it going, Ben?
Hey, it's me. I'm good. How are y'all doing?
Doing pretty well. You got a lot of stuff going on right now. Like, how are you keeping it all together?
Barely keeping it all together. On top of it all, today's my wife's birthday. So she was like, "Wait, you have an interview to do on my birthday?" I was like, "Yeah, it's fine."
Oops.
Well, I thought I was in trouble, and she started laughing. She was like, "That's fine. Like, I've been around you all day today already. Like, I'm gonna go take a nap."
I was
like,
"She's had enough."
Yeah, exactly. It'll let her recharge before I take her out to dinner.
Perfect. The birthday nap is an underappreciated birthday perk.
The birthday nap. I like that. I'd commented earlier that. No matter what today, like even the most mundane things, I was just calling them birthday, whatever. It's like, oh yeah, let's have a birthday trip to the grocery store. We're going to go have a birthday day of work, you know, that kind of shit. But it makes it sound more fun. It makes it seem less onerous.
I do the same thing to my lady, but I kind of poke at her a little bit. I'm like, it's the birthday month, or it's the birthday week. She hates it.
Right on.
But in addition to familial obligations, you've got a big tour coming up and a brand new record coming out. How are you keeping those things in your schedule?
It's been pretty intense. We literally just wrapped recording the new album yesterday. We hop in the van Tuesday to drive out to Philly. So it's been really intense. But at the same time, it's been really satisfying to have all these things going on simultaneously and feel like there's, you know, a lot of forward momentum happening within the band. So it's stressful, but it's exciting at the same time.
Yeah. So just yesterday, you finished recording this record. How did it feel to get like the last note out there?
Oh, my God. I don't know what it's like to give birth, I guess, pretty obviously. But I mean, I feel like this is about as close as I'm ever going to know. That sensation. I mean, we've been, you know, just really the last 9-10 months, you know, writing and refining and writing and refining, and then 3.5 weeks of tracking with Dave Otero. And literally when I strummed that last chord, I actually had to re-record it because I let out this contented sigh way too early. And so he had to kill the take and we had to do it again.
That should be on the secret track, just you sighing.
The secret track is, yeah, just a deep breath of relief.
How do you decide when the record's done? Like, is it's basically mastering is in mixing are going on right now?
Yeah. Dave's doing the, you know, polishing it up, making it sound like an actual album at this point. We had the time with Dave structured such that we knew we had X amount of days for every instrument. You know, we had so many days for drums. We wound up spending, I think, 2.5 days on drums, seven and a half days on guitars, 2 days on bass, a shitload of days on vocals. And then yesterday was finishing up vocals and a little touch of acoustic guitar for the ballad, you know.
Ooh. You've got,
there's not a ballad. Just to be very clear, there's not a ballad on the song. I don't want that quote to get taken out of context.
I was hoping that you had a big lighters in the air glam ballad for this one.
We'll save our Every Rose Has Its Thorn moment for the fourth record.
Good. Okay, that's a good call. So this next one's on $20 spin as well, right?
Yes, it's being released in North America on $20 spin and the rest of the world on Nuclear Blast.
So a week from now, are you going to still feel that relief, or are you going to have like a moment of panic in the van where you realize like you should have done a riff differently?
I mean, we've been listening to it. We did full pre-production for the album before we even went into the studio so that we would know exactly what it would sound like. Or at least we knew exactly what it sounded like at that moment. And then as we've finished tracking each level of instruments, you know, Dave's bounced out mixes for us so that it's not just sort of suddenly appearing for us, right? We had an idea going along every step of the way, what it was going to sound like, how the parts were going to work together. So I feel pretty confident in saying that at this point, we're really excited to release it. We're really proud of it, but we're also just glad to kind of have it out, you know, like now we can focus on playing, you know, the set for the Decibel tour, but also just upcoming tours, and then eventually figuring out how to play all the songs on the album live. That'll be a different endeavor altogether.
Have you decided maybe what the name of this record's going to be?
Oh, we have. I can't tell you yet. We're letting the labels handle all the, you know, announcement stuff, but it's a good name, I think. I guess that's kind of subjective, but I think everybody would be stoked on it. Yeah.
If we start throwing out words, will you tell us if we're getting like hot or cold?
Right. Yeah, we'll turn on the video part of Skype and we'll play a game of charades, you know. How many syllables sounds like?
On the previous album that you guys put out, you received a lot of heavy praise from some big places like Rolling Stone and Decibel. Do you think that praise kind of affected how you wrote and recorded this new album and kind of forced you either to change and evolve your sound, or did you want to somewhat replicate what you had already done?
I think that's a really good question. This is the first time for really all of us that any music that we were writing had any sort of expectations attached to it outside of anyone in the band. And, you know, the praise that we got for Hunted certainly surprised us. And, you know, it's something that we don't take for granted, but at the same time, we felt like it would be the wrong move to try to write anything that didn't feel natural to us. So this album is the most fully realized version of the four of us as a collective, trying to write music that reflects who we are and where we are in a given moment. I mean, let's see, Hunted came out in 2016, but really we'd written most of it by the end of 2015, maybe the very beginning of 2016. And then we're writing, you know, this album at the tail end of 2017. And a few years really makes a big difference in terms of what we want to hear, what we're capable of producing as a collective, you know, our sort of group level editing and sort of bullshit filter. And I think that I speak for all of us when I say that we're really proud of this album. I mean, hopefully any band is proud of anything they produce, but we're proud in a way where we think that we have produced something that feels real to us and is something we would want to listen to and isn't necessarily beholden to press-related expectations or even necessarily like fan-related expectations. Hopefully the people that like us continue to like us and they like this album even more. But we weren't trying to write something for anyone other than ourselves.
You haven't, you're not able to give us certain details about this. But will your wizard mascot make an appearance somewhere on the cover of the new record?
Oh yeah. Oh, he's there.
What do you have a name for him? What is the name of the wizard guy?
So the thing is, we do. I can never remember what it is. It's we. Anytime we talk about it, I have to ask. Like Zach always seems to remember. We joked about calling him Tim, you know, from Monty Python. But he really does have a name, and I'm not bullshitting you when I say I cannot remember what it is. If I remember what it is at any point, I'll yell it out, and we'll include it in the interview. But for right now, you know, perhaps it's best to just call him the Beer Wizard.
I mean, that's a great name too. I think that's something that Jordan and I have talked a bit about. Like, one of the cool things that your band does is that you know, in addition to creating your own sound, it has little throwback elements to big iconic bands. I mean, I'd say that most prominently you'd have Thin Lizzy with the harmonized riffs. And I think that the band mascot, you know, that's something that really needs to make a big return. All the big 80s bands had a mascot. And what is there now today? I mean, aside from the Wizard, I can't think of any. I guess the Ving Sevenfold bat thing.
Yeah, I mean, I guess Papa Emeritus kind of is that for Ghost.
Yeah, that's right?
Rob Flynn.
I'm not touching that. Nope.
Yep. That was last week's episode. We can move on. Okay. So you've mentioned in interviews in the past that you were doing a doctoral program in sociology. Are you still doing that program, or have you completed it yet?
Nope, still working on it. Phil and I are actually both in the same program. He is slated to finish his PhD in May, which is great. You know, we're going to be on the road almost nonstop between now and then. So good luck to Phil on that. I'm slated to be done next year in 2019.
That's awesome. I mean, obviously it must be a challenge to be in a massively successful metal band and also work through this program. Do you have time to, like, I don't know, do work on the road for this?
Well, that's one of the things that's interesting is that we all have, you know, everybody has commitments outside of their band, of course, but ours are such that we're actually, you know, sort of forced to work from the road, whether it's, you know, Zach handling beer-related production stuff from the road, or Phil and I conducting research, or, you know, answering emails, whatever. Dan doing drafting from the road. So it certainly keeps us busy. You know, if you're not driving in a given moment in the van, there's a pretty good chance you're in the back of the van working. But at the same time, we have been able to sort of strike that balance in all of our lives where even if we are having to work from the road, the primary focus is still in that moment on Chemists and, you know, trying to be the best version of ourselves as a band as we can be. Whether or not that includes being, you know, doctoral candidates, that might be a question better posed to our advisors. I don't know.
Well, you, so your field of study here, this, it's heavy metal itself. Is that correct?
Broadly speaking, I'm a cultural sociologist. It just so happens that I've been, you know, connected to the world of metal since I was a teenager, and it's the case that is most readily available and with which I have the most familiarity. But my work, more broadly speaking, is just about how people make and experience and make sense of their experiences related to art. So while my writing is, you know, looking at how that plays out in underground music, the theory that I try to generate is more broadly applicable. You know, could be used to make sense of how people think about literature in a given moment in a given, you know, part of a city, based on the sort of historical and economic history of, I say historical history, the cultural and economic history of that city. For instance, one of the theorists that I actually draw heavily on is this guy Claudio Benzecchi, who wrote a book on opera, of all things. Now, I don't know about you. I don't give a shit about opera. I don't enjoy it. I don't enjoy it at all. But the book is brilliant because it's a compelling look at how people make sense of stuff that matters to them, and it doesn't necessarily matter to other people. These people know that opera doesn't really connect to other people, but they're willing to spend their last dime to go see the opera. Well, I think that's true of heavy metal, too. Think about how many people, ourselves included, have spent money that we probably shouldn't have on concert tickets, you know, merch, buying albums, whatever, because this stuff matters to us. And one of the things that's interesting for me about my research is that I'm kind of my own, or I'm at least part of my own data set. If I had any sense, I probably would have never started playing heavy metal. There's certainly other musical avenues to make some semblance of money, but it's the stuff that matters to me. It's always mattered to me, and hopefully it always will. And I think that's a sort of beautiful thing about all art, but especially heavy metal. We don't tend to think about heavy metal and love in that sense very often, but it's true. It's a thing that people love and they dedicate their lives to.
Yeah, that's a subject that Jordan and I talk about a lot, and that there is so much a part of this subculture that we fully bought into that just doesn't make any damn sense at all. it doesn't make sense for me to have a massive and unwieldy collection of vinyl, or you know, a bunch of patches up and down my jacket that signify to maybe one other person in the city that I know this band.
I have a pile of band stickers that I'll do nothing with, but I can't get rid of them.
Same.
I just recently got a new desk for my home office and came across my little box of, you know, that I've been collecting over the years of band stickers, label stickers, and things like that. And I had that thought. I was like, what am I doing with these? Some of these I've had for 10 years. I've never put them on anything. I don't even know why I still have them, but I'm not going to throw them away. I don't really want to give them away. I'm just hoarding things at this point.
Yeah, I've got that big box of stickers too, and there's so many good ones. And it's like, well, if I put it somewhere, then I can't put it somewhere else. And what if I waste it? What if that was the bad location for the? Meanwhile, yeah, this goes back almost 20 years now.
Yeah. This might also say something about all of us and our feelings about commitment more broadly. I don't know. That might be a question better suited for my wife. I don't know.
Not on her birthday. Mm.
Yeah, not on her birthday. Exactly.
Well, as you're on the road, as you're experiencing life in a metal band, is this something that's feeding into your research? Are you seeing little things that maybe you can use in your research?
Yes and no. One of the things that's true of anyone doing any kind of scientific research is trying to balance your multiple roles, right? Like, even if you are engaged in a research project, you are still a person in other respects. You know, perhaps you're married, you're a parent, whatever, and you're trying to find the ways in which you can not have every little part of your life overlap with every other little part. So there are certainly moments when I'm talking to people, or I will carve out time on the road to talk to people specifically for research, but I try to compartmentalize things in such a way that when I'm in the van, when I'm on stage, that's Ben and Kimis. And then when I'm at home, or when I'm on campus, that's been the professor, that's been the researcher, that's been the husband. So while there's certainly much more potential overlap, I find that it allows me to maximize my sort of my time and my energy in a better way to focus on whatever sort of identity is most salient in that moment, rather than trying to do everything at once. If that makes sense.
That probably makes you a much more productive person as well.
Well, I certainly hope so.
Not trying to do everything at once is a challenge that I think a lot of people have. I certainly have. In a way, would you say that the subculture of maybe extreme metal is somewhat analogous with other maybe more highbrow cultures aside from opera?
Oh, yeah. One of the things that I think... Let me back up. Heavy metal has a history of being shit on. For some reasons that are more legitimate than others, but a lot of it has to do with the background of heavy metals being largely a working class style of music. It's not to say that we don't have people that come from wealthy backgrounds playing metal, but it was born out of working class experiences and frustrations, much like, you know, punk and hardcore. And so there's other forms of music that at least originated, even if they aren't necessarily still performed, largely by working class people and consumed by working class people. I think here, especially about rap, hip hop, and country music. Now, I know those things don't seem like they don't have a lot in common, but their foundations are strongly rooted in working class experiences and the experiences of people who do not have a lot of money, but who have a lot of rich cultural heritage upon which to draw. And I think that one of the things that sometimes fosters, not necessarily like fighting between members of different kinds of subcultures, but sort of animosity or like bristling at one another, is that it's easy to miss the forest for the trees. It's easy to see that people wearing patch vests look different from people wearing cowboy hats and cowboy boots. When in reality, the practices, right, the ways in which we've come to make the music and think about the music, the instrumentation, you know, it all comes from fairly similar origins. And so one of the things that has always made me interested in heavy metal, not just as a performer, but as a researcher, and just as someone who likes to think about things, I don't know what that term would be, a weirdo, a nerd, one of those, is that there's a universality to music, most forms of music probably, that even if we don't necessarily always see it, we're still all speaking the same kind of language, right? In terms of how we talk about music making us feel, the experiences that we have, the ways in which we, especially for people that are really tied up in music-based cultures and subcultures, we often think about our lives in relationship to when albums came out or concerts we saw, or I mean, you know, all of us can probably think about where we were and how we were feeling when we found out that Lemmy died. Most people outside of heavy metal may not even know who that is, but they also probably have some degree of the same sort of thing happening, maybe just not with Lemmy, maybe with other some sort of, you know, figure in another kind of musical culture. So that's why I think heavy metal fucking rules, in short.
You mentioned it, the working class origins of the genre alongside country music and rap, which kind of made me think of, I mean, I'm sure you've heard the sentiment, and it's a cliche at this point. I listen to everything except for rap and country. Which now that you put it in those terms, it makes me think, like, is this kind of a classist-based distaste for these forms of music that are for, you know, or at least originated by folks in economically disadvantaged subcultures?
I mean, probably so. I'm just gonna think. Yeah. I mean,
that's something that I'm just going to stew on for a while.
Well, I think that's interesting because I've certainly heard that same sentiment applied to heavy metal. So my wife and I live in a little neighborhood surrounded by people who are not part of this subculture at all. I mean, it's a very, 2.5 kids minivan kind of neighborhood. And I always get a kick out of them seeing us coming home from work. And, you know, it's like, you know, what you would expect a professor to wear, you know, like nicer clothes, maybe a blazer, that kind of shit. And then turn around a few minutes later and I'm going to band practice or like packing up to leave for tour, and it's all black. It's, you know, a battle vest, that kind of stuff. And our neighbors have asked, you know, like, what kind of music do you play? And I always just tell them heavy metal. And I always get the same response where they're trying to be polite, but they're also obviously not super comfortable with the phrase heavy metal and the sort of implications contained therein, especially people that are maybe middle-aged and have kids and things like that. I assume they start thinking about biting the heads off bats and satanic sacrifices, the 80s satanic panic, things like that. And that, I think that same sort of disdain of, oh, I don't listen to heavy metal, is, I think it's probably more complex than just class, but I think class is a big part of it.
Yeah, when people ask me, like, what type of music I like in a work setting or someone I don't really know, I usually don't even bother saying heavy metal. I'll just say rock and kind of leave it at that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Because rock somehow has this more universal appeal, even though, you know, we know as members of the subculture that there's lots of bands that are labeled heavy metal that are much closer to the rock end of the spectrum that would probably jive with other people's tastes. But because the label heavy metal gets applied, oh God, blood, the devil, and bones, and all that, drugs, and sex, and murder.
All the fun stuff.
Yeah, all the things that make life worth living.
Yeah, in my professional settings, I sometimes let loose that, like, hey, I have a heavy metal blog and podcast, and they're like, get the fuck out of here. That's
yeah.
That's weird.
Well, and this goes back to what I had said earlier about trying to, you know, compartmentalize things in a reasonable way. I never tell my students or my colleagues or anyone what I do outside of, you know, the professional realm or whatever, because there's a whole host of assumptions that go with it, and I don't want those assumptions to cloud their interactions with me, especially with students. I, you know, they need to understand me as professor, not as cool dude that plays in a band and tours around, because I don't want them to ever think that we're friends or anything like that. They're 18, and it's been a long time since I was 18, and I don't have anything in common with them. I'm there to teach them, and that's it.
So you don't start classes by kicking a chair around and sitting the wrong way on it and being like, listen up, kids.
I'm here to share some truth with you about the social world.
Would 18-year-olds care at this point, or would they just be like, I can make beats on my computer?
I mean, honestly, I think you're right. I think most of them would probably not care either way. I think most students, I probably don't give them enough credit. I probably don't give most people enough credit. I don't have a very high opinion of the human race. And so, you know, when it comes to interacting with students, I just assume the worst. But you're right. They probably, especially out here, I mean, you know, in Colorado, a lot of the kids that come to college out here come from wealthier backgrounds and tend to not select into the, you know, metal or punk or hardcore or underground anything kinds of music. There's lots of hippie jam band shit that really lands out here.
Fish.
If I told them I was in the String Cheese incident, however, they would love me.
So do you think that that is perhaps related to the legalization of marijuana in Colorado?
Do I think what's related to it?
The jam band preference?
Yeah, I mean, there's not really, actually. A lot of what's happened in Colorado after the legalization of marijuana has just sort of been an accelerated version of what was already happening. So Boulder, for instance, which is the nearby college town, has been hippy-dippy central for decades. Now, it's been changing for other reasons. It's become a more sort of, I don't know how you want to think of it, like nouveau riche hippy-dippy land where people wear their Birkenstocks and they have dreadlocks, but, you know, mom and dad own a chain of luxury condos on up and down the West Coast or that kind of stuff. I think the biggest changes that we've seen in Colorado with the legalization of marijuana have just been the influx, the incredible influx of people who are moving here either. I mean, there's a lot of people that unfortunately move here because they're like, oh, my God, man, weed's legal. And we all keep trying to tell people, fuck it. It's legal in Nevada, too. Go live there. stop coming here and making it hard for us to afford rent.
But the thing I've heard is that people, working class and musician types have been getting pushed out of Colorado because of basically rising costs of living over the last several years.
Oh, absolutely. It's the cost of living here has grown exponentially just in the last 5 years. And we happened to move here a little bit before pot was legal. And honestly, didn't even realize that it was on the ballot or anything. And then as soon as it got, you know, passed and everything, it's been weird to see how quickly Colorado has changed and the ways in which development and gentrification have affected the music scene, sort of broadly speaking. People getting pushed further and further away from the sort of downtown city core. I mean, if you are a working musician and you're trying to buy a house, fucking good luck. You got to get 45 minutes outside of Denver, maybe. Maybe you can afford it there.
I'm from Austin. That's very much been the case here for the last decade or so.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
It's crazy to see like all the you know, clubs that everybody has great fondness for get closed down because a luxury condo is built next to it, and then like suddenly there's noise complaints and they're priced out too.
Yeah, that's certainly a concern out here. Yeah.
You move for the culture and then in the process to destroy it.
Yeah, absolutely. The irony there, I think, is probably lost on most people who are moving out here.
I wanted to ask you, because you said you're going starting out on this tour just next week, right?
Yeah, we leave Tuesday to drive out. The first date is on Thursday of next week in Philadelphia.
Right on. The Decibel magazine tour featuring Enslaved, Wolves in the Throne Room, Merkur, and you guys. Do you feel perhaps like odd man out on what is ostensibly a black metal bill?
You know, we've been asked that quite a bit, and honestly, no. Enslaved hasn't been, and I don't think they've even identified themselves as a black metal band in, what, 20, 25 years? They still certainly have black metal elements, but they've been doing their own kind of proggy, weird take on heavy music for so long that I think they sort of transcend the label of black metal. Wolves, obviously, probably the most straightforward, if you will, black metal band on the bill. And, I mean, Merkur, I think it's Merkur. I don't know.
We have no idea how to pronounce it.
Yeah, Merkur. I'll ask her and I'll get back to you. I think it's Merkur. She certainly has her black metal moments, but she's got so much of the sort of Nordic folk influence as well that I feel like it perhaps sells the other bands a little bit short for them to all be sort of lumped in as being black metal. I mean, that said, we certainly play at a slower pace than all of the other bands. But no, I think it's actually going to be a really cool experience. And I think that there are enough sort of common musical themes across all four bands that for folks that want to, they can find something to latch on to through each set. There'll be some folks that come out for us that maybe are not as into Wolves or vice versa. And, you know, that's their prerogative, and I would suggest their loss. But I think that the diversity of the lineup is what makes it really exciting. And also because we, like I said, we play a little bit slower. Are we the only band that has cleans? No. Are we the only band with guitar solos? I'm asking you. Enslaved has some solos.
Enslaved, the record previous, I haven't listened to the newest one. The previous record definitely did have guitar solos in it.
So like I said, there's not as common themes.
Widdly cool. So you've got, I'd say that you've got the guitar flares down over the other bands on this one.
Works for me. I'll take that.
Are you ready to make the transition from playing a 45, 50 minute headlining set to like an opening 25 minute set?
It's certainly a challenge to try to cram songs in when, you know, your songs are long like ours are. We really struggled to figure out how to get four songs in 30 minutes. We managed to do it, but we didn't have a lot of songs to choose from, you know, within those confines. It's a different approach, right? Like we're playing, instead of knowing that we're going out and playing to a crowd that's primarily there for us, there's the element of sort of needing to go out and win people over, or at least reaffirm people's interest in your band. And although, you know, everyone wants to play a little bit longer than they do, probably. I think that's probably true for most bands. I think the challenge of putting together a shorter, tight set that not only do we find compelling, but we think is a good sort of snapshot of the band has been a really sort of energizing challenge. And we're really excited to take this set out on the road and sort of smash people over the head with it.
That's awesome. Obviously, you've got the head brewer of True Brewing in the band. Would you guys consider yourselves as a whole like connoisseurs of beer?
I wouldn't consider myself that. I don't even really drink beer as much as I used to. In an effort to not die as quickly as I probably will anyway, I've really cut back on beer. For the last probably like 8 months, I really don't drink much beer at all. I'm a tequila man now. But at the same time, you can't be around Zach Coleman and not learn things about beer. I mean, the dude is just a brilliant encyclopedia of, you know, how beers are made, how the tastes that I had previously lacked the vocabulary to articulate, how those tastes get produced, how you can refer to them, how you can use that to communicate with other people who know how to make beer, or at least know beer. So Zach has certainly taught me a lot of things about beer. Well, taught all of us. But I think the other three guys certainly have much more refined tastes for beer. I tend to be more of a, is this good? Then I will drink this one. What should I get? Okay, that's the one that I'll have. That's my level of beer wisdom.
That's about the same for me as well. We have a friend who regularly tours with his death metal band, basically as an excuse to try all the breweries all across the country, which it seems like a really great 1-2 punch of a vacation.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, anytime we've been on the road, we've always tried to, you know, stop at breweries along the way. Zach, you know, knows people around the world that make beer, and so it's always been fun to go in and try different kinds of beer, and also to just sort of make those connections, because it turns out a lot of people that brew beer also love heavy metal, go figure. But we're actually, all right, I'll tell you this, and then I'll have to actually check whether or not we can have it in here, but okay. We're doing this Decibeers thing, us and Enslaved, and we are going to breweries, I think, for 2/3 or so of the tour dates, and we're gonna like film it and have pictures and shit of us all going in, trying different beers, and basically for us, it's an awesome excuse to go hang out with Enslaved, and for Enslaved, they're excited to drink a bunch of beer.
That sounds fantastic, because yeah, Decibel also does like the beer festival in Philly.
Yeah, or, absolutely. Oh, and that thing is awesome. Yeah, it's in Philly. It's awesome, man. That whole, we played that last year, and just the way it was put together was so well run, and so many cool breweries from all around. We got to have beer from so many. We got to have Hammerheart, and I'd never got to have Hammerheart beer before, and that shit is incredible. I've never had beer like that before in my life.
That would be Austin Lund of Panopticon, right? That's his brewery.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
I've heard great things about that.
It's great. Austin is a great dude, great friend of ours, and he has a very unique approach to producing beer. Also, his beer tends to be very strong, so we're definitely looking forward to the next time we get to cross paths with him and drink his ridiculously strong smoked beers.
that's the smoked element is a whole new level. The next time you're in Texas, I've got a recommendation. Locally produced craft batch. It's called Lone Star. It's delicious.
Oh yeah, I thought it was Lone Star. I thought it was French. Okay.
Target.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So the first date coming up here next week, Philadelphia. Is there going to be any city left for you to play?
We certainly hope so. Yeah. I haven't really been keeping up with the fallout after the Super Bowl. Has it been pretty wild? I mean, I assume it was wild that day, but has it been wild since then?
It's been continuous. Today was the parade. I watched a video of a man eating horse shit, and then I was like, you know what? I'm done. I think I'm done keeping up on how the city's doing.
Yeah, you know, I saw the title for the video going around, and I was like, this is some clickbait shit. There's no way that's actually real. But he really ate horse shit?
Yeah.
Welcome to Philly. He didn't pick it up either. He put his face down on the ground, grabbed a nug, and picked it up in his teeth and chomped down. I've never seen anything quite like it. It's been haunting my dreams ever since. I have to just share it with people because I can't get it. It's like, what is it, that videotape that you know, kills you unless you share it with somebody? The Ring? Yeah, that's what it is.
Oh, God. It's the shit ring.
Yeah.
God, I was curious, but now I don't want to see it. I don't want to be haunted by that.
I actually wanted to bring up your other band, Glacial Tomb.
Okay.
You recently did an Aus Rotten cover of Fuck Nazi Sympathy. I was curious as to what made you guys decide to do that song.
Well, I mean, it's a badass song, first of all.
Oh, yeah.
True.
You know, given the sort of socio-political climate of our country, it felt like it was something that we could do in that band that was our way of, without trying to necessarily make it about ourselves. Try to like make a statement or do something on behalf of not even like marginalized people, because what the fuck are three dudes from Denver going to do that, you know, well-funded, well-structured organizations can't do a million times better. But just to sort of contribute to the discourse that was happening already in metal, that certainly metal has had and will continue to have, you know, all sorts of issues with myriad forms of bigotry. But there were enough bands and enough people and enough writers writing about metal that were saying, you know, like, fuck this moment of white supremacy, fuck this moment wherein people are not, who have all historically been disenfranchised and have not been allowed to feel safe in their skins, feel particularly unsafe in not just their skins, but in their homes and their communities in this country. Fuck this moment wherein the sort of core ideals around which our country was at least supposedly built are being upended in favor of an absolute fucking nightmare. And fuck Nazi sympathy is, in my mind, in our minds collectively, a sentiment that if you can't get behind it, you're probably on the wrong side of things, and we don't really want to fuck with you anyway.
Yeah, that's well stated. Every day, I see something that is just completely stomach-churningly awful coming from like the highest parts of our society and being legitimized, and it's horrifying.
Yeah, exactly. It was man, there was a meme going around last year that said, you know, do you remember that moment when there was a malfunction at the Large Hadron Collider, and scientists said it could have changed reality, but we have no way of knowing? Well, fuck, I think it's happened. And like, I'm not like some sort of conspiracy theorist or anything, but like, that's the only way that I can really make sense of how fucking upside down things have gotten. And it's not like things were beautiful all around, you know, 2-3 years ago, but like, holy shit, like things are just like none of it makes sense anymore. And so I just hope that we're in a pocket universe, or at least that I fell into a pocket universe. And that if that's the case, there's a version of me that was used to everything being much worse than it was, who's in that version of the world and is like, oh man, you know, this is like a C+ version of the world. This is pretty tight.
I'd like to believe that there's like a correction that will come, because it doesn't make any sense for like incel Nazi dorks to get profiled in glossy magazines like they're dapper geniuses for believing in the same backwards shit that Nazis did in the 40s.
Yeah, it's
gotta go back to the they gotta go back to the lockers.
it's really fucking it's unsettling, and it's scary. And going back to your question about why cover that song, Mike, the drummer for Glacial Tomb, is a man of color. And, you know, it's one of the things that's true about Colorado is we don't have a lot of racial diversity. But that said, I've got a lot of friends here. There are a lot of important people in our lives and in the city and in the scene that are people of color, men of color, women of color, women, more broadly speaking, trans people. And seeing people that you care about, like, really struggle with, you know, how is this going to go when I leave for work today? How is it going to go when I drop my kid off for school today? How, you know, is today going to end up being okay? Because there's always a chance, there always has been a chance historically that things are going to go south real quickly. But it seemed like in the lives of people around us, that fear, that concern was so much more real, so much more powerful than it ever had been. And it was just sort of like, all right, we have a limited number of things we can do, but maybe making a statement, maybe raising a few $100 for, you know, the Human Rights Campaign and NAACP, maybe that's something. It certainly beats the hell out of just sitting around and, you know, feeling upset and feeling lost and not doing anything about it. You know, it's an attempt to do something. It's an attempt to further discourse and to push back against this sort of prevailing discourse of bigotry and intolerance. Yeah, plus, like I said, the song rips. So, you know,
you've got the new album coming out. You've got this Decibel tour coming out. And I know you're really excited to play Lawrence, Kansas on it.
Oh, yeah.
You've got a bunch of festivals coming up. You've got Maryland Death Fest. I guess after all this is done, where do you see Chemist?
Hopefully on the cover of Us Weekly. Wait, Us Weekly? Why the fuck is that the one that I went with?
Oh, we got it. You said it. It's recorded.
Hopefully Us on the cover of Teen Beat or Tiger Beat or whatever that is. Man, honestly, like, our expectations for this band have always been, let's do what we can, let's have fun, and let's make art that feels legitimate to us. The fact that it has ever expanded beyond, you know, the edges of Denver totally blows our minds. So where do we see Chemist going next? Wherever we can. We're going to keep doing everything we can, and, you know, we're going to keep touring. We're making it over to Europe for the first time for a very short run in April. We're, you know, planning to try to go back later this year for a longer run, maybe early next year. Hopefully Metallica is really paying attention. I mean, you know, there was that picture of James Hetfield wearing the Urantsi Pazuzu shirt. Maybe he's done his research. He knows other bands on 20 bucks spin. Really just wherever we can go and wherever we can continue to share the art that matters to us with people that hopefully it resonates with. That's where I see us.
Badass. To that note, you're one of in one of few bands really in the last several years that's really kind of broken out big, and you didn't have any grand intention of doing that. What is it you think that really made the difference and helped you connect with more people?
Man, I have no idea. Part of it is dumb luck, right? It's happening to the same way that even getting a band together, and having it, you know, last more than a few months. I mean, think about how many people have been in, like, go to metal archives and look at some of your favorite musicians. They've been in like 50, 60 bands. And it's because it's hard to find, you know, a group of people with whom you can write music that you find compelling, that you can get in a van with and not murder each other. That you can share a tiny hotel room or the floor of a stranger's house with. I like to think that there's something palpable about authenticity on behalf of people that make music. And this is not to say that we are any more or less authentic than others, but just that I think a band that writes music that they find compelling, that they aren't trying to, you know, jump on a trend or actively push back against a trend, I think those kinds of bands resonate with certain kinds of people. I think we also just happened to luck out that the music we were writing, you know, clicked with the right people in terms of even having, you know, 20 bucks spin pick us up and having media outlets pay attention. And, you know, trying to write stuff that is not heavy for the sake of being heavy. We're never going to be the fastest band. We're never going to be the lowest tuned band. But we try to write music and sing songs and write lyrics about life and life in ways that are relatable without being overly pessimistic, right? Like, life is bullshit. Life sucks. It sucks most of the time. But trying to find those moments wherein you can connect with people from different backgrounds, different parts of the country, different parts of the world, by recognizing that, you know, life's filled with sorrow, but it's not always the worst, just generally the worst. I think all of those things come together. And in our case, it just happens to be at the right, you know, right, the right moment, sort of culturally speaking, wherein this kind of music is a bit more broadly accepted than it would have been, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago.
Would you, as a guitarist, would you have any one piece of advice for a younger guitar player looking to up their game a bit?
Ooh. One piece of it. All right. I'll try two answers. If they're really young, like, you know, like a teenager, like, I started playing guitar when I was 12, so I've been doing this for 21 years. Holy shit. And if you, I don't know why a 12-year-old is listening to this podcast. Their parents should probably have DHS calls on them.
Not listen to this.
Yeah, but, you know, like, if I'm speaking to someone who's like a teenager, don't get in a hurry. Maybe that's true for everyone. When we were in the studio, I was talking to Dave Otero about this, and I talked to him for a piece that I wrote for Noisy a while back, and he said this thing that has really stuck with me, that within the underground we have a tendency to Sort of think about the classic song structure, like the pop rock song structure, as being something that's easy to do somehow. And the reality is that writing a song that is compelling and that is catchy and that will stick with people doesn't, you can't just sit down and do it. If every death metal dude that said, well, I'm just going to sell it and write a pop song could do it, we would have lots of, you know, weird dudes with beer bellies and fat necks writing successful pop songs. And it's, you know, it's not true. Like, it takes a long time to figure out what you're good at. When I was a younger guitar player, I loved super shreddy, just like, like the more notes, the better. And I always thought my dad was wrong when he would say things like, well, that's not, you know, how many notes you play, it's what notes you play. The older I got, the more I realized that was true. But I was in such a hurry at that point to try to be the fastest or the best, only to realize much later that I was never going to be as fast or as technically proficient as those guitar players. And so what I needed to do was try to figure out how to play what I wanted to hear. And that takes time. It takes time to sort of meld all your influences together. Like, even though I play heavy metal and that's all I've ever played, I don't only listen to metal, which I guess a lot of people say, but like, I don't really listen to a lot of metal. Like, my favorite band, Steely Dan.
Interesting.
Yeah, you don't hear it.
You're not alone in that sentiment. I've heard a number of metal musicians. Megan from Couch Slut, a huge advocate for Steely Dan.
Oh yeah, because they covered Steely Dan, right? Didn't they do like Babylon Sisters?
Yeah, they did.
And I understand why, like, for lack of a better term, dad jazz rock doesn't resonate with a lot of people, but realizing that I loved Steely Dan, and I also loved Neurosis and Yob, and that I also loved, you know, whatever bands like, like American black metal bands like Whoa, Weakling, you know, whatever. Those influences seem pretty disparate, but there's a reason they all resonate with me. And trying to figure out how to articulate that first in words and then through constructing music was how I've learned to, to whatever extent this might be true, play music that sounds like me. Now, whether or not people hear my guitar playing and think that it sounds like me or is unique is obviously up to them. But it took me a long time to figure out that I needed to try to... You can't sit down and write a classic pop song. You can't sit down and find your voice. These things take time. And it doesn't matter if you have the newest whatever kind of amp is hot, or in the case of like stoner doom stuff, the sexiest, oldest mad amp, orange, whatever that you can find. It's figuring out how to do the things that best represent you as a creative person. That's the way you're going to make your mark to whatever extent. That's the way you're going to make something that actually matters in this world. Otherwise, you're just going to be chasing this sort of ephemeral notion of success and individuality that is always going to be out of reach because it's based on what you're seeing around you and not necessarily what's happening within you. And I realized this just took a real, like, weirdly spiritual kind of turn, and I don't mean for it to. But yeah, guitar players, slow down, pay attention to what you're thinking and feeling, and don't buy into the hype of any kind of style of music or piece of gear. There's a reason that Eddie Van Halen can sit down with, you know, a piece of wood with a couple strings on it, plug it into any kind of amp, and sound like Eddie Van Halen.
That's great advice. I think that's, in a weird spiritual angle, because I guess that makes sense. I mean, art is, in effect, spiritual. It comes from inside.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm not a spiritual, religious dude at all. I don't believe in anything metaphysical, but... one of the things that's amazing about music is the way that it interacts with us through a cultural lens, and then all the stuff that happens in our brains, and our brains make all these wonderful neurochemicals, and we feel good if we hear music we like, or we feel weird if we hear music we hate. And just paying attention to all that stuff, that's how, not just for music, I think for any kind of creative endeavor, I think that's how you make something authentic, is making something that you would want to hear or see or read or experience, and then releasing it to the world and seeing what happens. And also expecting that everyone will hate it. Don't ever assume anyone's going to like anything you do.
That's also great advice.
I just want to say thank y'all for having me on here. I want to thank everyone that's ever listened to Chemist or ever does, or Glacial Tomb, or you know, anything that I ever do, it means a lot. I appreciate that people want to hear the words that come out of my mouth and the notes that come out of my fingers. And hopefully, you know, more people find something compelling in what we're about to release. And I'm real excited for what 2018 has to offer, because 2017 was such a fucking shit show that can't go anywhere but up.
Hell yeah. Well, thank you so much for taking the time out of your day, especially your wife's birthday, to talk to us. And everybody listening, you can check out Chemist on tour on the Decibel Magazine tour. Go see him and check out their new record when it drops. Thank you.
You're listening to 66.6 FM, Radio TOVH, The Flush.